KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Americans are poorly informed about the U.S. Constitution. That's the conclusion of researchers at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg Public Policy Center, which released the results of its annual Constitution Day survey this week. It found that nearly 40% of respondents could not name a single First Amendment right, and just a quarter of them could name all three branches of government. As constitutional challenges mount against the Trump administration, academic institutions, among others, we dig into the survey results and take your questions in this hour forum on the constitutional provisions you want explained. We'll get started after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Our president has been described as unconstrained by constitutional norms. The left has been called the biggest threat to the Constitution's guaranteed freedom of speech. While constitutional protections are at the center of our most heated political debates these days, Americans know very little about them. The Annenberg Public Policy Center finds that nearly 40% of Americans cannot name a single First Amendment right, meaning the guaranteed freedom of religion, speech, the press, to assemble or petition the government. Its annual survey also found that more than half of respondents wrongly believed undocumented immigrants had no constitutional rights at all. In this hour forum, we look at the implications of the survey results, take your questions on the Constitution, and get your thoughts on how to inspire more interest in the document that is the foundation of our democracy. Joining us is Kathleen Hall Jamison. She's professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication and director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, currently a Shorenstein Fellow at Harvard University. Hello, Kathleen Hall Jamison.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks also Jack Rakoff, William Robertson Co-Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. His latest book is Revolutionaries, A New History of the Invention of America. Good morning, Jack Rakoff.
Morning, Mina.
Well, Kathleen Hall Jamison, I'd like to start with you. That question that I referenced in the introduction on the First Amendment was a new question, I understand, for your survey, and I was curious why you decided to ask it.
We try to ask a question for Constitution Day every year, September 17th, where the schools are supposed to be teaching the Constitution that day under the Byrd Amendment, that will tie back into things that people are reading in the news. And this is a year in which we think virtually everything in the First Amendment has some relevance to what's going on in the news, as you pointed out in your introduction.
Yes. And so in terms of the way that the answer broke down, it was interesting that 48% could name freedom of speech among those who could name a First Amendment right. And that 15% said freedom of religion, and just 14% identified freedom of the press. You've asked this question about Congress's ability to stop the media from reporting on issues of national security. Did stepped-up attacks on the news media in the past year change that at all?
We can't say from a survey, which is basically a snapshot in time, what the factors are that are influencing change. We can certainly surmise that it's possible that that is a factor. One of the things that worries us is that when you have potential challenges to the press, if people don't know that there's constitutional protection, the nature of the discussion about it is different. And we think that if people were more deeply grounded in the rationale for protecting the press from government interference, if that were more deeply taught and more deeply understood, people would be more likely to stand up and defend press freedom.
Yes, it seems like that question on Congress's ability to stop news reporting on national security issues remained relatively unchanged. But you did note that opposition to them doing it declined some. Do you think that's significant?
I wouldn't make too much of year-to-year variability. I think what's more important is that the number that are willing to let Congress do that is pretty high. And as a result, the understanding that it's constitutionally prohibited is lower than it ought to be in an environment in which there are actual threats.
Yes. You note that a lot of people knew that under the Constitution, atheists and Muslims have the same rights as other citizens. But I was a bit shocked to find that 21% of respondents, for example, thought that atheists did not have the same constitutional rights, and that even more, I believe it was 24% believe that Muslims did not.
Yeah, and I wonder sometimes if we are so accustomed to seeing the numbers which suggest very low knowledge of things such as branches of government, doesn't jade us. When we were putting the press release together, I wondered whether we shouldn't feature the percent that thought they didn't have rights and say that that's a particular concern, but decided in the context of so much bad news that we had to take the one place in which we had fairly high affirmation of constitutional protections and say, well, at least that's substantially more than 50%.
Can you talk about the rationale behind the question involving undocumented immigrants and also what that question was exactly?
The question is asking whether people understand that those who are here illegally or who are undocumented do, in fact, have constitutional rights. And that those are actually very long-lived and well-established in constitutional law. And the reason for asking the question is that in the context of an immigration discussion in which people talk casually about deportation and suggest in many instances that what we really ought to do is just round them up and get them out of here, that there's a fundamental misunderstanding that we have due process and equal protection rights for people who are here, even those who are here without traditional legal standing and here without traditional citizenship.
You've talked about these results being worrisome. And can you just explain what worries you most?
When we look at what you predict from these areas in which there's low knowledge, what you predict to are attitudes that potentially destabilize our system of government. A colleague and I published an article a number of years ago in the Georgetown Law Review based on a far more extensive survey than this, but which had many of the same questions. And we looked in a model at what you are more likely to say if you do not know there are three branches, if you do not know why we have a veto, if you do not understand some of the basic protections in the Constitution for individual rights and liberties, what you are likely to say if one posits that the Supreme Court issues a series of rulings that you don't like, they're basically unpopular, shouldn't we perhaps just think about getting rid of the Supreme Court? So the thing that we are looking at is what's the effect of lack of knowledge of these foundational concepts on your willingness to say, well, maybe we could just get rid of the Supreme Court. And as your ignorance rises, your likelihood to say, well, maybe we could just get rid of the Supreme Court, you know, begins to rise as well. And that's problematic. It's problematic. The lack of knowledge is problematic for a second reason. If you want to understand, for example, when the travel ban is offered and the courts come into play, why the President of the United States just doesn't simply stand up and say, well, I don't care what the courts say. I'm going to put it into place. You don't understand there's a constitutional reason that he does not do that. And the fact that he doesn't is evidence that our system at some fundamental level is working. You don't understand why it is we have branches and we have the protections in checks and balances. Well, you're more likely then to let a president overreach or a legislature overreach or a court overreach. So to some extent, these institutional protections exist because the public is willing to defend and grant them. I mean, if you remember going back in history, you know, Jackson did not honor the court's ruling, and as a result, we had the Trail of Tears, one of the tragedies in our nation's history. He basically said, I don't care what the court says. He basically let a tragedy happen. But by the time we got to Cooper v. Aaron, enforcement of civil rights, Dwight Eisenhower did what the court said he needed to do. And Nixon, in the case of the tapes, did too. Now, what's the difference between Jackson's time and those two later instances? And by the way, Truman did the same thing. He followed the court when the court in the Youngstown-Seals case said, no, you don't do that, Mr. President. The difference is an understanding of checks and balances and public understanding of why they are important. If we let that erode, we tacitly may license overreach by one of our branches.
Jack Rakoff, can I get your reaction to the survey results as well and your concerns about lack of knowledge of our constitutional protections, for example? I mentioned your most recent book, but you've also written Original Meanings, Politics and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution in 97, which won the Pulitzer. So you've been working hard to try to get people aware of this foundational document.
Right. Yeah. Plus, he also published an annotated U.S. Constitution and Declaration of Independence the year before revolutionaries, where I suppose I share many of Kathleen's concerns. These are not entirely new issues. I think there have been repeated surveys over the years that, that demonstrate that on critical questions, you know, there's an appalling absence of knowledge about constitutional fundamentals. I think particular confusion about the Bill of Rights. I think there are other surveys which, if you simply read statements from the first eight amendments or first ten amendments to the Constitution to Americans without saying this actually comes from the Bill of Rights, they have no knowledge of what they're listening to and no willingness to support the values portrayed therein. So yeah, I think like most educators, and I do a fair amount of work off and on with high school teachers who teach the Constitution. Yeah, of course we share these concerns. On the operational side, although there's God knows ample causes for alarm in our current political universe, I'm not sure I'm quite as alarmed as Kathleen might be about prospective damage to the Constitution per se. I mean, getting rid of the Supreme, since most observers think it's highly difficult, if not literally impossible, to change any of the substantive provisions of the Constitution by constitutional amendment, getting rid of the Supreme Court, would be a really tough proposition. Or if you talk about free speech, free press, there are a lot of legal issues that have to be hacked out. I mean, hate speech in the American understanding, that's a very complicated and difficult notion to undo. But the fact is, there is a pretty deep body of entrenched law that most jurists are well aware of. And so even if we had significant shifts in public opinion, I think the institutional mechanisms are strong enough now to protect some basic constitutional understandings. Although, of course, since the appointment process to the Supreme Court and federal judiciary in general has become so highly politicized over the last 3 to 4 decades, I would say going back to the Nixon years, one has some anxiety about just how independent the judicial branch actually is of political currents. Even in Trump times, I have a lot of residual faith in the institutional structure of governance, though, like most observers, I'm prepared to concede it's being sorely tested.
Well, let me open the phone lines because I'd like to get our listeners' reaction to the survey results, thoughts about what can be done to best address the lack of knowledge of the Constitution. Kathleen Hall Jamison has mentioned a high-quality civics education and more press reporting that talks about the meanings and constitutional protections and cites them in relation to stories that we are reporting, but also just ask people for their basic questions about constitutional provisions that they want explained or ones they want to discuss. The number is 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also post your questions on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can post them on Facebook, on Twitter, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. In listening to what you were saying, Jack Rakove, I think about the best way to approach reading the Constitution, which seems less like you're trying to parse it so much and really digging into this specific language as it is to see it to get an overall sense of what the U.S.'s principles and morals really are.
Yeah, I agree. And if I can expand on that a bit, I think the deepest absence and in some ways the sorest point in teaching American constitutional history is how do you relate the founding period, that's to say, the 1770s, 1780s, when the Constitution was framed and ratified, to the three Reconstruction Amendments, adopted in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War from 1865 to 1870. And then I think probably to make sense of what happened with the New Deal. To me, I think the most important story, when I teach this to my students at Stanford, I usually like to say that the failure of the first Reconstruction from 1865 to 1876 is the great tragedy of the American Constitution. And failing to understand why Reconstruction came to its unhappy end, if one doesn't understand the forces that were unleashed in the South after Appomattox, after the Civil War was concluded, one doesn't understand how white supremacy was reinstituted in the Jim Crow regime. If one doesn't understand, the long road that gets you from, the 1870s to the civil rights jurisprudence and litigation in the 1950s and 1960s, you just don't have an adequate account of constitutional history. This is important at the civic level. It's important, I think, that citizens understand that and to really have a way of mapping and grasping how do you compare or triangulate these different events. I think it's also important at the level of jurisprudence. To my way of thinking, the worst decision the Supreme Court has made in recent years is the Shelby County decision from, I guess, 2014, from a few years ago, which essentially gutted significant parts of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And it did so, I think, because Chief Justice Roberts and the four other conservatives on the court failed to take adequate knowledge, failed really to come to grips with the meaning of Reconstruction and what had happened thereafter. Since we're living in a period where our racial anxieties and concerns and attitudes have been so much at issue, to me, the single most important thing to teach, I think, is less the specific provisions of the Constitution that Kathleen's survey was designed to measure. What do people actually know about? I think the most important thing is to kind of convey a basic narrative of the history of the Constitution, which really pays as much attention to the politics of constitutionalism as to kind of the core legal provisions which regulate our ways of thinking.
Well, Kathleen Hall Jamison, do you agree?
I think it's also important. I agree, yes, but I think it's also important for us to have in our heads narratives about what's happened in the past that tie back to an understanding of places in which we failed. I think it's important that everyone remembers Japanese internment when we get into times in which we are being asked to be fearful of others. And looking at the Korematsu case and looking at, we've got a video on the Annenberg Classroom site, by the way, that I encourage everybody to take a look at if they're unfamiliar with that case. It is a reminder that we've gotten it wrong historically at some times. And it also invites us to say, out of that understanding, how should we see these current circumstances and what lessons have we learned so that we don't make the same kinds of mistakes again?
Well, Jim asks, is it true that a presidential pardon can only pardon federal crimes, that the pardon does not protect from state prosecutions? Jack Rako?
It seems to be true. I mean, there's a lot of hope that whatever happens, whatever Trump may do with the federal pardon, if it involves members of his family or his organization or himself for that matter, that the New York Attorney General, among others, is still free to pursue. There are various legal options he could still pursue. So that, I'm more a historian than a lawyer, so there are some things I want to be a little diffident about reaching final judgment on. But, that is my understanding of the possibilities.
Well, let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Hi, Ruth Ann. Are you there?
Yes, good morning. Good
morning.
I wanted to bring up that in terms of free speech in the Constitution, because I hear people make this mistake all the time. I don't have a free speech claim against my next-door neighbor. If he says something, I can't say, you're violating the First Amendment, nor do I have it against a store. I do have a free speech claim against the government, because that's what the First Amendment is applying free speech to.
Does Kathleen Hall Jamison, do you want to add anything to what Ruth Ann is saying?
Yeah, I think it's a very useful exercise to always remember the wording of the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment. It is about what Congress shall not do. So it shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the full exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. So it's a protection against government, against Congress.
Well, Will asks, what right do healthcare. What right to health care does the Constitution guarantee? I'm hearing liberals claiming that we have a right to health care, but I don't know on what that claim is based. Mention of that in the Constitution, Jack Rakoff?
Well, I have my own theory that it'd be nice to bring it in under the Ninth Amendment, which says the enumeration of these Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That clause was added in response to kind of the particular structure of debate back in 1787-88 as to whether or not adding a Bill of Rights to a Constitution would be a good or a necessary idea. The problem is nobody's ever figured out what are the other rights that the people retain. I think you could make a pretty plausible argument if you're a liberal lefty kind of guy, which I suppose I am, in this sense almost anyone today, I think, would believe that that we all should have a right to health care, that I think we now regard that in a way that would have been inconceivable in the 18th century when you can't deal with most diseases. But, of course, we know today you can deal in one way or another with most diseases, either to try to cure them or at least ameliorate their consequences. So it seems to me, and I don't know if Kathleen's surveys have ever tested this, but I think if you did polling on this and asked the American people, do we have a fundamental right to health care, I bet you would get some pretty respectable numbers. To bring it into the Ninth Amendment would be a bit of a tricky exercise, but I for one would favor trying to do that.
Well, let's ask her quickly while we have her on the line. If you have polled on that, and also Will's question and also Jack Rakoff's comment, makes me think of whether there were any interesting splits along party lines in the responses you got on the survey.
Well, first, when somebody says there's a right, you've got to ask, where are you grounding the right? Are you saying there's a constitutional right? Are you saying there's a moral right? A moral right can be something that you're asserting that is not constitutionally based. Is there explicitly in the Constitution a right to health care access? No, of course there is not. But there are implicit rights that have been found over time as jurists have read the intent of the Constitution. There's no explicit right to privacy, for example. It's an implicit right as the court has held in some circumstances. So I think the question when people assert rights is, how are you grounding the rights? There are some differences based on party. There are some differences based on ideology. On some of the foundational issues, conservatives are more likely to get the knowledge questions right, a higher level of knowledge there than in some other areas. But we haven't broken out the entire range of surveys, the survey across time by ideology or party, and so I don't want to start to get into that now.
Well, let's take more.
I have one point to add here, though. I've done a lot of work on the evolution of thinking about what is the nature of a Bill of Rights, how does it function constitutionally. If you went back to the 18th century, remember the Bill of Rights was omitted from the original Constitution.
Yes.
Madison introduces a set of proposals on June 8, 1789, and then finally on December 15, 1791, Virginia provides the necessary vote to get the original 10 amendments ratified. Prior to the idea that a Bill of Rights actually consists of a set of legal guarantees that citizens can enforce, there's a prior understanding that we have fundamental natural rights to life, liberty, and property. Of course, in Jefferson's famous rephrasing of the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness replaces property. I'd be prepared, again, maybe I just sound like an academic speculating here, but I'd be prepared to make an argument that notion of a right to life in a modern society where health care is available, it's not that great a leap to go from that natural rights understanding to saying maybe via the Ninth Amendment or some other set of legislative mechanisms that we have more than a moral right. We should have a constitutionally grounded right to health care.
I think the other thing that your point brings up, Jack Rakoff, is what maybe we frequently forget, which is what was signed, right, in 1787, it resembles, but it isn't the same document that we see today, how much it has evolved over the more than two centuries. Well, we'll get to more of your questions and comments after the break. We're talking about the U.S. Constitution with Kathleen Hall Jamison of the Annenberg School for Communication and Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and with Jack Rakoff at Stanford University. He's William Robertson Co-Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science there. I'm Mina Kim in for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. On September 17, 1787, delegates to the Constitutional Convention signed the Constitution, creating a new U.S. government. And it's a document about which many Americans know very little. That was affirmed by the Annenberg Public Policy Center's annual survey out this week that finds nearly 40% of Americans, for example, did not know what was in the First Amendment. We're joined by Kathleen Hall Jamison, Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication and Director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. We're also joined by Jack Rakoff. He is a Professor of History and American Studies and Political Science at Stanford University. And we're also joined by David Levine, UC Hastings Professor of Law. Hello, David Levine.
Hi, Mina. Thanks for having me in today.
Yes, thanks for joining us as well. Well, let me go right to our calls because we've got a lot coming in. Ty in Oakland. Hi, Ty.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Earlier, your speaker was talking about the protection for non-citizens.
Yes.
And I wonder how would that jive with the 14th Amendment, which I can't remember the whole thing, but if you would be so kind as to read the 14th Amendment and see if the due process is afforded to a non-citizen as well.
Well, the 14th Amendment, the one that says all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. David Levine, that sounds like a good question for you.
Sure. Well, I think the answer is that at least if you're in the United States, a person would be entitled to due process of law. That would be, for example, let's say an immigrant owned a building and there was an issue regarding taxes on the building. They certainly would be entitled to due process with regard to that. If a criminal who happened to be an undocumented person had committed a crime, they certainly would be entitled to due process. So it applies in a number of different circumstances. Now, it comes and goes depending on different situations. So, for example, all of us crossing the border have barely any rights at all, whether citizen or not. So it would just depend on the exact situation.
Well, Noel writes, why isn't civics being taught in schools since school curriculum is locally controlled? Kathleen Hall-Jamison, we often hear that the best way to try to improve people's knowledge of the Constitution and our democratic values is through civic education. But I guess the question is how to make it more of an emphasis.
I think the most effective way of doing it is to integrate the teaching of civics into the teaching of history so that as we move across history, we understand those moments at which the Constitution has been at issue and how the challenges in that moment have been resolved in our constitutional system. So I think teaching it as a standalone invites people to teach it as if it's a function of memorizing certain data and certain facts, whereas integrating it into history gives us a sense of how we've gotten to where we are, the mistakes we've made, the things we've done right, how we've learned about it, and how our understanding of the meaning of our Constitution has changed. One of the reasons that we see less civic education than we have in the past is there's so many more pressures being placed on the schools. One of the reasons the Civics Renewal Network, which is a place everyone should go to if they want to find out what the best of the best is from places like Library of Congress and National Archives and iCivics, which is Justice O'Connor's program, and our own Ann Arbor classroom, one of the things they ought to take a look at when they go there is all the materials that are available at no cost that one can integrate into a history curriculum or into other areas of social studies or into a traditional civics course.
When you say pressures, do you mean that education, for example, has been pressured to have more of a focus on economics or to respond to economic globalization?
Yeah, well, if you look at the move toward testing students in certain kinds of areas and schools being rewarded for test scores in certain kinds of areas, what you see is an emphasis legitimately placed on important areas in which we need to get foundational knowledge. But we tend to increase the amount of teaching time to focus on those areas in which there's going to be testing and accountability as a result for teachers and school systems. To the extent that we don't have civics incorporated into that structure, we minimize the likelihood that when there are pressures to try to get certain things done, the thing that's not likely to be tested is the thing that's going to drop out. Civics in that kind of a pressured environment tends to drop out.
I see. So you're not saying like STEM and civics, for example, is a zero-sum game here.
No, it shouldn't be a zero-sum game. And one of the advantages of having materials available on the web, which is the Civic Renewal Network's materials are all online on the web, is that teachers can ask students to look at them at home and then spend a little bit of time in the classroom talking about what they understand as a result of their exposures at home. So we need to find a way to extend the value of the school day into after-school hours with materials that are engaging enough that students will work with them on their own and then bring them back into the classroom. That's a solution. I urge, by the way, people who are interested in rights of people who are non-citizens to take a look at the video on Yik Kuo, which is a San Francisco case, 1886, in which the Supreme Court interpreted the 14th Amendment to say that there were equal protection rights there for a person who was a non-citizen.
Well, Kathleen Hall-Jamison, I know you stayed with us longer than you were able to originally, so we really appreciate it.
Thank you for letting me talk with you.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, professor of communication at the Annenberg School for Communication and director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. All right, we're also talking with Jack Rakove of Stanford University and David Levine of UC Hastings, and we're going to more of your calls now. Let's go to Carrie in San Jose. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I was wondering if your guests could comment on perhaps the worst judicial decision of our time, Citizens United, and how equating money to speech seems to subrogate our rights as human beings to speech and other rights.
Jack Rakove, you want to comment?
Well, I suppose in general, I don't favor the decision, but I try to remain somewhat more open-minded about its consequences. I think one thing that political scientists have learned is that you can spend enormous amounts of money, under the kinds of pretext or protection that Citizens United provides, without gaining much electoral benefit. So I think it might be helpful to. I suppose in general, I'd say the principle is wrong. And I don't think corporations in this respect deserve the same protection as individual citizens. And there's a lot of argument about how this is used by the Koch brothers and others to try to preempt the electorate. But I'm not wholly sure what the consequences are. I mean, it may well be the case that that kind of expenditure matters more in primary elections than it does in general elections, that you can waste tons of money. Certainly the case of those who opposed Obama's reelection in 2012 without really getting any benefits therefrom.
Well, this is another question, David Levine, related to immigrants' rights. Mike writes, immigrants have no right to live in this country unless the U.S. specifically grants them. So how does due process apply to deportation of such aliens?
Sure. Well, I mean, once you're in the country, if there is a, let's say somebody was arrested and then they became subject to deportation, it isn't simply at the whim of some police officer that somebody's put on an airplane and sent out of the country. They have the right to a hearing. They have the right to appeals from that hearing. So there is a process in place. Now, it doesn't have to have the same, burden of persuasion as a criminal case would, but there certainly is a process in place because they are persons who are in the country and therefore protected by the Constitution. It's a matter of the context of how due process comes in.
Well, this
it's
is
really important,
Jack Rico.
It's really important to go back to the two sentences from Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, Mina, that you read previously, and to understand very explicitly that the two sentences of Section 1 are about both citizens and persons, and the distinction is a conscious one. The first sentence is there really to overcome the decision in Dred Scott, the 1857 case, and to ensure that all African Americans born in the country, whatever state they're born in, became citizens both of the United States and of their own state. But the use of persons in a period when immigration was already beginning to swell is significant in two. Citizens and persons denotes two very separate, distinct legal categories. And the 14th Amendment, in its respective ways, addresses both categories.
Well, let's hear from David in Palo Alto. Hi, David.
Hi. I had a question concerning the 10th Amendment, which limits the federal government to the power specified. And I believe it's actually reiterated elsewhere in the Constitution that powers not granted to the federal government go to the states. Now, I hear this a lot from my more conservative friends in arguing for states' rights, but also for the development of, say, NASA or NOAA or anything else that the government does, right? Obviously not specifically specified in the Constitution. How has our understanding of the limits of federal power evolved over time?
That's a good question. Jack Rakove, do you want to start answering?
I'll start. I'd be interested to see what David has
yes.
to say. Well, the usual line of the 10th Amendment is a truism. Powers not delegated have not been delegated, and powers reserved have been reserved. So, in effect, what you have to do is to go back to the main text of the Constitution and try to figure out what powers have actually been delegated. If you approach this issue historically, the single most important fact about the 10th Amendment, or what became the 10th Amendment, is that when it was debated in the first federal Congress in 1789, the nub of the debate was whether or not you should add the adverb expressly. Powers expressly delegated. And the idea of adding expressly would have been, read as a kind of example of you know, what's sometimes called a stricter construction. So it would place a greater premium on being able to point to some specific clause as giving a more immediate test of this. But expressly was defeated. And so you have to go back to reason the way actually Hamilton and Alexander Hamilton and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson were reasoning in 1791 over whether or not Congress had the authority to incorporate a national bank. Madison, who is becoming a bit stricter in his interpretation, says, well, no, we proposed that in Philadelphia in 1787, the power to incorporate, and that power was rejected, and so therefore it doesn't exist. But Hamilton, in his brilliant memorandum on this, and most members of Congress say, yeah, but the necessary and proper clause, you know, which is, it comes to the end of Article 1, Section 8, which details all the legislative powers of Congress, that's really all we need. In a sense, the 10th Amendment, Thomas Jefferson was closely attached to it, and, you know, ostensible states' rights advocates say pretty much the same thing. But in many ways, it is a truism, and you have to go back to the main text of the Constitution and see what's actually there.
Well, David Levine, do you want to weigh in quickly?
Yeah, quickly. I was going to bring it up to date, which is the 10th Amendment is highly relevant in the context of these sanctuary cities lawsuits because at a core, there's a concept that Justice Scalia introduced called the anti-commandeering idea, and that the idea is that the federal government can't force the states to cooperate with federal programs like sanctuary cities. All they can do is use carrots and sticks. And so that's become really, really relevant at this point in terms of what money might be at stake if San Francisco or the state of California wants to declare themselves a sanctuary. So the 10th Amendment is quite alive and well.
Yes. Well, speaking of other hot button topics, Robert writes, can you discuss the intent of the Second Amendment, specifically the meaning of the term a well-regulated militia and how it is interpreted today? David Levine, staying with you.
Sure, no problem. Until just a few years ago, it was understood that the emphasis was that it was not an individual right. In 1937, the Supreme Court said that that was the case. But then, in the more recently, up to the Heller decision is a famous one, the Supreme Court shifted against Justice Scalia, who decided that his version of reading the history was that it was an individual right. But until a very few years ago, that just was not the case at all. So people have delved through the history and come up, I would say, basically with what they want to find. But that's where we are currently, is that it is an individual right. It does apply to the states. And while regulation is possible, at its core, there is that individual right.
Jeffrey,
I have to weigh in on this.
Thoughts on this.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts because I wrote a historian's brief, which some of my colleagues signed in the D.C. versus Heller case, and I've gone extensively through the evidence. And all I'll say is that the so-called history that purports to justify Justice Scalia's view or the majority's view, which says there's an individual right of self-defense, it's just preposterous. If you read Scalia's opinion. And read it with any detail. It's a terrible joke of historical reasoning. It's intellectually, it's an embarrassment. There's no question that in 1789, when this was discussed, the only issue being discussed by the framers was the role of the militia in maintaining a republic and whether or not the national government should be obliged to ensure that the militia would exist. There certainly was a common law right of individual self-defense, which being a common law right is subject to all kinds of legal regulation. But the idea that the framers of the First Amendment constitutionalized, and I emphasize that as a verb, constitutionalized an individual right of self-defense under the Second Amendment is just preposterous.
Well, we're talking with Jack Rakow, William Robertson Co-Professor of History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. And we're talking with UC Hastings Professor of Law, David Levine. And we're talking with you, our listeners. Let's go to Morris in Sunnyvale. Hi, Morris.
Good morning. You have no greater support of the thought of universal health care, but to couch it under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as a right, I think is a little bit of a stretch. If you were to say that health care is a right of the citizenry, then why isn't housing and food also a right of the citizenry? I'd love the support of universal health, but I think putting it under the Constitution and Bill of Rights is
a stretch too far and a slippery slope.
Well, Morris, thanks for registering that. Jack Rigoff, I think you were the one who said that about the Ninth Amendment, correct?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm happy to concede it's a bit of a stretch, but of course, a lot of constitutional argumentation is about stretching. So I'll just
repeat
the
basic point.
You're saying
nothing's impossible? No, I'm
well,
just kidding.
You know, as the lawyers say, arguendo for purposes of argument. But look, you know, my basic argument is saying the Ninth Amendment, which is essentially meaningless. I mean, there is no jurisprudence in the Ninth Amendment. Let's give it a little content, and then let's link it to the idea that the right to life, which, after all, is what healthcare is about, whether you rely on Thomas Hobbes or John Locke or the great theorists of natural rights from the 17th century, the right to life was regarded, per se, as one of the great natural rights. So why not? And if you demonstrate that public opinion has shifted, which I think is the case, that I think we expect healthcare to be available, and we're shocked when it's not available. You know, it's a bit of a stretch, yeah, but that's how creative constitutionalism takes place. And in some measures, I'm happy to be a creative constitutionalist.
Well, Morris.
Which is what James Madison was.
Morris, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Jake in Santa Rosa. Hi, Jake.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Great program this morning. I had a question about the Electoral College, and I'm interested in, I guess, first, what the chances are that it could be, that it could be removed at some point, given the Republican majority now and the fact that they have benefited from two elections where they lost the popular vote, and so it doesn't seem likely that that will ever go away with a Republican majority. But I'm also really curious from a historical point of view. I thought that the Electoral College was originally there to prevent, you know, for lack of a better term, a nutcase from getting into to the presidency, and it seems that that didn't work in this last election.
Jake, thanks. Jack Rakoff, I want to stay with you on that question. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I've written a lot about this one, too. Well, you know, it's hard to generalize from the last election. I mean, I agree with the basic judgment. I think the important thing about the Electoral College is, and I've written a lot about this, is that when it was adopted, it was not the most attractive option available. It was the least unattractive option available. The framers adopted it at the very close of their debate. Most of them had very little idea how well it was going to work. They were convinced, for reasons that turned out to be fallacious, that a popular election would not produce an effective choice. As soon as you get to the first contested election in 1796, and then again in 1800, when it's essentially Jefferson and John Adams, you realize that a popular vote would have produced an effective choice. They're very nervous about legislative elections because they wanted to make the president constitutionally independent of the legislature. And there was a lot of going back and forth about that. Nobody had any idea who the electors were going to be. George Mason said at one point they might be men not even the first or even the second character. In other words, they might be third-rate people. And as soon as we have contested elections, 1796, so long as George Washington is running for president, it doesn't matter what rule you follow, he's always going to be elected president. When Washington announces he's going to retire in 1796, the electors very quickly became the objects or the tools of partisan competition. So there's a lot to be said about this. I face this argument all the time. People say, well, we could never amend. I mean, Jimmy Carter said this to me once. We can never amend the Electoral College. We're going to have it 200 years from now. That's true if you never talk about it. I happen to think that if you engaged in a sustained public discussion, if you focused, which actually happened in the early 1970s when we were close to getting rid of the Electoral College, in fact, I think if you engage in a sustained popular discussion of it and look for ways to amplify it as a public issue, then we could try to attract it. If you just, you know, shrug your shoulders and say we can never get rid of it, so why bother talking about it, then, of course, we're bound to be stuck with it.
Well, let me hear next from Tanae in Sunnyvale. Hi, Tanae.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind?
So I have a quick question for the panel. So Thomas Jefferson famously said that a man should not be compelled to wear the same coat as he did as a boy. And a lot of scholars basically interpret this as next generation should not have to live by the Constitution that was written, many years ago. So my question for the panel is, would you be in favor of a system in which the Constitution was rewritten every 50 or 100 years?
Well, let me start with David Levine quickly.
Okay, well, as I remember, the other thing that Jefferson had in mind was he said something about the blood, you know, refreshing the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots. You know, he had in mind that it would be short term, and I think that's proven to be totally wrong. I guess it would just be so dangerous to do that. We have the amending process. We have a lot of play in the joints because of the necessary and proper clause. So I can't imagine that we would do anything like that. Just as with, if I could go back for a second to the Electoral College, I guess the one point I make on that would be I can't imagine that small states would give up all the outsized power that they have, and you would need to have the agreement of so many states to make the change.
Well, Jack Rakoff, we're coming up on a break, but quickly, would you be in favor of that? Rewriting the Constitution every 100 years?
Well, there's a great exchange on this, which everyone should read. There's a famous exchange of letters between Jefferson and Madison. It comes after they've been discussing adding a Bill of Rights, where Jefferson was much caught up with some French theorizing, as was his wont, using actually very good demographic information, says, well, we should revise the Constitution every 19 and a half years. And after the break, I can explain where he came up with that number. It wasn't gematria. Right. It came from someplace else. And Madison, in a very typically Madisonian way of speaking, you know, writes back and, you know, talks about what we now call all the transaction costs that would take place if, in fact, every 20 years or so or on some regular cycle.
Ever the pragmatist, Madison. We'll put a link actually up on our website to what you're referencing, and we also have a link to the Civics Renewal Network that Kathleen Hall Jamieson referenced earlier. You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Jack Rakoff, History and American Studies and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University, and also UC Hastings Law Professor David Levine. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Mina Kimbin for Michael Krasny. David Levine, I'd like your take on this question. A listener writes, why does Congress no longer declare war when we fight wars? This feels like more of a political question to some degree, but do you want to remind us of those powers and how things have been playing out in our government?
Well, the power is expressly Congress's. The problem has been enforcement. In fact, I think it was just yesterday that Congress decided, or Senate decided, not to take up something that Senator Rand Paul wanted to do, which is essentially to expressly talk about this and to expressly authorize the use of force in Afghanistan and elsewhere. So these issues have gone back and forth, but essentially it's that because Congress hasn't enforced it through the power of the purse to say, if you don't come to us to declare war, we won't give you any money for the military, that as a practical matter, the president has been able to engage in all kinds of activities. The current activities are all based on an authorization after 9/11 in 2001, and it is highly attenuated, a very weak basis for all the things we're doing in the Middle East.
Well, let's get to more calls. Joe in Oakland. Hi, Joe.
Hello. How is everybody this morning?
Well, thank you. What's on your mind, Joe?
Okay, I've always had a question. Third Amendment. The government cannot, without your consent, quarter soldiers in your own home. Now, suppose there were an insurrection, force majeure, which branch of government is responsible for getting rid of them?
Well, Jack Rakoff, do you want to attempt to answer Joe's question?
Yeah, I'll soon. Actually, I should tell Joe I'm in a good mood because I'm in Chicago and the Cubs won a laugher last night, so I'm quite happy. But, you know, the key thing to know about the Third Amendment is, okay, first thing is, you know, it requires congressional action. The key thing to know about it, it's in one sense, it's the most trivial of amendments. It doesn't really affect anything we do and never will. But it was linked historically to a very important aspect of Anglo-American constitutional thinking, really going back to the Glorious Revolution of 1689. In England, and that is the idea that issues relating to housing and, you know, and the rules of war whereby armies would fight were matters for legislative regulation. They were not just something that the crown or the executive branch could do of its own commander-in-chief authority. So it's the Third Amendment. Yeah, we don't fully perceive it when we look at it, but actually it's linked to this deep principle, the superiority of, you know, the rule of law, even in the conduct of warfare.
Well, this listener, yes, David
sorry,
Levine.
Nina. I was just going to say, I joke about it that it's the best amendment because it works perfectly. There's no litigation about it. There's never any problems.
it's the best protection we've ever had.
Well, it's interesting how much emphasis there have been on the amendments, of course, but Carl is asking a question about the articles. He writes, perhaps you can speak to Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3. How is the exclusion of Indians interpreted? What includes them in, quote, us? Anyone want to take that one?
Indians not taxed. I mean, the basic point you have to remember there is that if you look at the Native American population at the end of the 18th century, there are, you know, different pockets of tribes, the remnants of tribes, living within the effective boundaries of settlement. But, you know, most, you know, the bulk of the Native population is living west of the area of settlement, Indians not taxed. So they are, I don't want to discuss this in terms of Indian sovereignty, a term that's often used and I think is really a source of confusion, but it's a way of delineating Native Americans who are living close to whites and those who are, in effect, living beyond the settlement line.
Well, we are out of time. I will leave you with this tip from Michael, who says, here's a way to remember the First Amendment, invoking RAPS, Religion, Assembly, Petition, Press, and Speech. Jack Rakove of Stanford University and David Levine of UC Hastings College of Law, thank you both for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
And thanks to our listeners for their questions about the Constitution. I encourage you to continue the conversation online. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Managing editor Ethan Lindsay and VP of News Holly Kernan. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Another hour coming up.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.